that flashed through my head, but it was short and to the point. The Ocean View is one of those nondescript one-story motels a block off the wide boulevard that parallels the beach. It was not yet tourist season, and the rates were still down, red neon vacancy signs alight all up and down the street. The Ocean View didn't really have a view of anything except the back side of the motel across the alley. The basic cinder block construction had been wrapped in what resembled aging stucco, but the red tiles on the roof had the uniform shape and coloring that suggested recent manufacture. Dietz pulled into the temporary space in front of the office, left the engine running, and went in. I sat and stared at the car keys dangling from the ignition. Was this a test of my character, which everyone knows is bad? Was Dietz inviting me to steal the Porsche? I was curious about the exact date Anne Bronfen had died, and I was itching to check it out. I had to have a car. This was one. Therefore, I glanced at the office door in time to see Dietz emerge. He got in, slammed the door, and put the car in reverse.
"Number 16 around the back," he said.
He smiled at me crookedly as he shifted into first.
"I'm surprised you didn't take off. I left you the keys."
I let that one pass. I always come up with witty rejoinders when it's too late to score points. We parked in the slot meant for room 18, the only space available along the rear. Dietz knocked. Idly, I felt for the gun in my handbag, reassured by its weight. The door opened. He was blocking my view of her, and I had too much class to hop up and down on tiptoe for an early peek.
"Rochelle, I'm Robert Dietz. This is Kinsey Milhone."
"Hello, come on in."
I caught my first glimpse of Rochelle Messenger as we stepped through the door into her motel room.
"Thanks for coming up on such short notice," Dietz was saying.
I don't know what I expected. I confess I'm as given to stereotyping as the next guy. My notion of ladies who work in massage parlors leans toward the tacky, the blousy, and face it, the low class. A tattoo wouldn't have surprised me. A hefty rear end, decked out in blue jeans and spike heels, tatty dark hair pulled up in a rubber band. Rochelle Messenger was my height, very slim. She had flyaway blonde hair, a carelessly mussed mop that probably cost her $125 to have touched up and snipped every 4 weeks. Her face was the perfect oval of a Renaissance painting. She had a flawless complexion, very pale, finely textured skin, pale hazel eyes, long fingers with lots of silver rings. Expensive ones by the look. She was wearing a nice blue silk blouse, a matching silk blazer, pale blue slacks that emphasized her tiny waist and narrow hips. She smelled of some delicate blend of jasmine and lily of the valley. In her presence, I felt as dainty and feminine as a side of beef. When I opened my mouth, I was worried I would moo.
"God! How'd you end up with a piece of shit like Mark Messenger?" I blurted out instead.
She didn't react, but Dietz turned and gave me a hard look.
"Well, I really want to know," I said to him defensively.
She cut in.
"It's all right. I understand your curiosity. I met him one night at a party in Palm Springs. He was working as a bodyguard for a well-known actor at the time, and I thought he had class. I was mistaken, as it turns out. But by then we'd spent a weekend together, and I was pregnant."
"Eric," I said.
She nodded almost imperceptibly. "That was 6 years ago. I'd been told I could never have children, so for me it was a miracle. Mark insisted on marriage, but I refused to compound the initial error in judgment. Once Eric was born, I didn't even want him to see the child. I knew by then how twisted he was. He hired a high-powered attorney and took me to court. The judge awarded him visitation rights. After that, it was simply a matter of time. I knew he'd make a try for Eric, but there was nothing I could do." So far, she'd left more unexplained than she'd managed to clarify, but I thought it was time to back off and give Dietz room to operate. By unspoken agreement, this was his gig in much the same way the Bronfen interview had been mine. Dietz was getting into work mode, his energy intensifying, restlessness on the increase. He'd started snapping the fingers of his right hand against his left palm, a soft popping sound.
"When did you last talk to him?" Dietz asked her.
"To Mark? 8 months ago. In October, he picked Eric up at the daycare center and took him to Colorado, ostensibly for a weekend. He called me shortly after that to say he wouldn't be returning him. He does allow the boy to call me from time to time, but it's usually from a payphone and the contact's too brief to put a trace on. This is the first time I've actually known where he was. I want my child back.
Deet said, I can appreciate that. We understand Mark has family in the area. Will they know where he is?
She smiled contemptuously. Not bloody likely. Mark's father denounced him years ago, and his mother's dead. He does have a sister, but I don't believe they're on speaking terms. She turned him into the police the last time he got in touch.
No other relatives? Friends he might have tried to contact?
She shook her head. He's strictly solo. He doesn't trust a soul.
Can you suggest how we can get a line on him?
Easy. Call all the big hotels. The cops quizzed me as to his whereabouts after the Gold Mart robbery. He'll be loaded, and believe me, he's the sort of man who knows how to treat himself well. He'll book himself into first-class accommodation somewhere in town.
Deet said, Do you have a telephone book?
Rochelle crossed to the bed table and opened the drawer. Deet sat down on the edge of the king-size bed and turned to the yellow pages. I could tell he was dying for a cigarette. Actually, if I were a smoker, I'd have wanted one myself. It was the same bed where I'd caught my ex-husband with a lover during the Christmas holidays. What a jolly season that was. Dietz looked at me.
How many big hotels?
I thought about it briefly. There are only three or four that might appeal to him, I said, and then to her. Will he be registered under his real name? I doubt it. When he's on the road, he tends to use one of his aliases. He favors Mark Darien or Darien Davidson, unless he's got a new one altogether, in which case I wouldn't know. Dietz had flipped through the yellow pages to the hotel-motel listings. Hey, Dietz? He looked up at me. I tried the Edgewater first, I said. Maybe his showing up at the banquet last night was just a piece of dumb luck. He stared for a moment until the logic sank in. Then he laughed.
That's good. I like that.
He found the number and punched it in, his attention focusing as someone picked up on the other end.
May I speak to Charles Abbott in security? Yes, thanks, I'll hold.
Dietz put a palm over the mouthpiece of the receiver and used the interval to fill Rochelle in on events to date. He interrupted himself abruptly.
Mr. Abbott? Robert Dietz. We talked to you yesterday about security on the banquet. Right. I'm sorry to bother you again, but I need a quick favor. I wonder if you can check to see if you have a guest registered there. The name is Mark Darien, or Darien Davidson. Possibly some variation. Same man. We believe he'll have his little boy with him. Sure.
Apparently, Dietz was on hold again while Charles Abbott checked with the reservations desk. Dietz turned to Rochelle and took up the narrative where he'd left it. She didn't seem to have any trouble following. Watching her, I began to realize how strung out she was, despite the poised facade. This was a woman who probably didn't eat when she was under stress, who lived on a steady diet of coffee and tranks. I'd seen mothers like her before, usually pacing back and forth in a cage at the zoo. No appearance of domestication would ever undercut the savagery or the rage. Personally, I was happy I'd never laid a hand on her pup. By the time Dietz caught her up, her expression was dark. You have no idea how ruthless he is, she said. Mark is very, very smart, and he has all the uncanny intuitions of a psychopath. Have you ever dealt with one? It's almost like a form of mind-reading. Dietz was on the verge of replying when Charles Abbott cut back in. Dietz said,
You do. That's right, the boy is five.
He listened for a moment.
Thanks very much. Absolutely.
He placed the receiver in the cradle with exaggerated care.
He's there with the kid. They're in one of the cottages out and back. Apparently, the two of them have just gone down to the pool to have a swim. I told Mr. Abbott there'd be no trouble.
She said, Of course not.
You want to call the police?
No, do you? From the look that passed between them, they understood each other exactly. She picked up a leather handbag from the bed and took out a little nickel-plated derringer. Two shots. I gave him a smirky look, but his expression was neutral.
God,
and he'd criticized my gun.
What's your intention if we succeed in getting Eric back? You can't go home, he said to her.
I have a rental car, which I'm dropping at the airport. My brother's a pilot, and he'll pick us up at a charter place called Neptune Air. Mark and I used it once.
Dietz turned to me.
You know it?
More or less. It's this side of the airport on Rock Pit Road. He turned back to Rochelle.
What time's he flying in?
9, which should give us time enough, don't you think?
It should. What then?
I've got a place we can hole up for as long as we want. Dietz nodded.
All right. It sounds good. Let's do it.
I held a finger up, snagging Dietz's attention. I tilted my head toward the door. Could I have a word with you? He flicked a look at me, but made no move, so I was forced to charge on. I said, I've got something I want to check out, and I need some wheels. Why can't I take the rental car while you two take the Porsche? You know where Messenger is, and you're on your way over. I don't see why I need to be there. There was a silence. I had to struggle not to jump in with a lot of pointless dialogue. I'm too old to beg and whine. I just couldn't picture us in a motorcade driving across town to a kidnapping or a shootout with Mark Messenger. My presence was redundant. I had other fish to fry. Rochelle was loading her gun, both chambers. It was too ludicrous for words, but something about it gave me a leaden feeling in my gut. I could see Dietz debate my request. In an odd flash of ESP, I knew he'd have felt safer if I were going with him. He held out his car keys, not quite making eye contact.
Take my car. There's a chance Messenger might spot us if we pull into the hotel parking lot in it. We'll take the rental car. What I said before goes, nothing dumb.
Same to you, I said, perhaps more sharply than I intended.
I'll meet you out at the charter place.
Take care.
You too.
Chapter 26. It was 4:42 when I turned into the entrance to Mount Calvary for the second time that day. A long line of eucalyptus trees laid lean shadows across the road. I passed through them as though through a series of gates as I wound my way up the hill. I turned left into a parking area near the office and pulled in beside a splashing stone fountain in a circle of grass. Bright orange goldfish darted among the soft, dark green filaments of algae. I locked the car. The tall, carved wooden doors to the non-denominational chapel were standing open. The stone interior was dark. I passed a double row of flat monuments, displaying various types of granite markers and styles of lettering. Hard to decide which I preferred at such a quick examination. I reached the office and pushed through the glass door. The reception area was empty, the desk bare except for a neat stack of postcards depicting the crematorium. What kind of person would you write to on one of those? I spotted a discreet sign saying, Press buzzer for service, attached to a device about the size of an electric letter opener. I pressed a lever. Magically, a woman appeared from around the corner. I wasn't really up on the fine points of cemetery ethics, so of course I told a lie. Hello, I wonder if you could help me. From the woman's expression, she was wondering the same thing. She was in her 40s, dressed in prim office clothes, a gray wool dress with a touch of white at the neck. I was sporting my usual jeans and tennis shoes.
I certainly hope so, she said.
She kept her judgment in reserve, just in case I was rich and had a passel of dead relatives in need of lavish burial. I believe my aunt is buried here, and I need to know the date she died. My mother's in a nursing home, and she's worried because she can't remember. Is there some way to check?
If you'll give me the name.
The last name is Bronfen. Her first name was Anne.
Just a moment.
She disappeared. It was hard to picture how she'd find the information. Was all this stuff on a computer somewhere? In some old file cabinet in the back? If the date and place of death didn't coincide with Bronfen's story, I was going to do some digging and see if I could come up with the death certificate. It might mean a few phone calls to Tucson, Arizona, but I'd feel better knowing what had really happened to Anne. She returned in a remarkably short period of time, holding a white index card which she passed to me. There wasn't much on the face of it, but it was all pertinent. I soaked up the typed information in a flash. Surname Chapman. Given name, Anne Bronfen. Age, 40. Birthdate, January 5, 1900. Sex, female. Color, white. Place of birth, Santa Teresa, California. Place of death, Tucson, Arizona.
Ah. Date of death, January 8, 1940.
That was interesting. Date of interment, January 12, 1940. The space allotted to the funeral director had been left blank, but the lot number and the plot number were filled in. "What's this?" I asked. I held the card out, pointing to the bottom line on which the word cenotaph had been handwritten in black ink. "That's a commemorative headstone for someone who's not actually buried in that plot." "She's not? Where is she?" The woman took the card. "According to this, she died in Tucson, Arizona. She's probably interred there." "I don't get it. What's the point?" "The Bronfens might have wanted her remembered in the family plot. It's a great comfort sometimes to feel that everyone's together." "But how do you know this woman's really dead?" She stared at me. "Not dead?" "Yeah, don't you require any proof? Can I just come in here and fill out one of these cards and buy somebody a gravestone?" "It's hardly that simple," she said. "But yes, essentially." She had launched into an explanation of the particulars, but I was on my way out. I drove to the board and care in a state of suspended animation. All I'd really wanted was corroboration of Bronfen's tale, and here I was with another possibility altogether. Maybe Agnes Gray and Dan Bronfen were the same person after all. I thumbed my nose in Dietz's general direction as I turned right on Concord. I parked the Porsche at the curb and got out. For once, there was no little twitch of the curtain as I pushed through the gate. I went up the porch steps and rang the bell. I waited. Several minutes passed. I moved over to the porch rail and peered toward the back of the house. At the far end of the driveway, I spotted a single-car garage. Attached to it was a lath house and a dark green potting shed with a big, handsome padlock hanging open in the hasp. Behind me, I heard the front door opening. "Oh, hi. Is that you, Mr. Bronfen?" I said, turning my attention back. The man in the doorway was someone else, a frail old fellow with an air of shuffling indecision. He was thin and bent, his shoulders narrow, his fingers twisted with arthritis. He wore a much-washed plaid flannel shirt, thin at the elbows, and a pair of pants that came halfway up his chest.
"He's out. You'll have to come again," he said,
his voice a pastel blend of raspiness and tremor. "Do you have any idea what time he'll be back?"
"About an hour," he said. "You just missed him."
"Oh, gee, that's too bad. I'm the contractor," I said, in this totally false warm tone I use. "I guess Mr. Bronfen's thinking about an addition to the shed out back. He asked me to take a look. Why don't I just go on out there and see what's what?"
"Suit yourself," he said.
He closed the door. Heart thumping, I made a beeline for the backyard, figuring my time was going to be limited. Patrick Bronfen was not going to appreciate my snooping, but then if I were quick about it, he'd never know. The shed was perched haphazardly on a concrete foundation that did a sort of zigzag between the single-car garage and the house. This looked like the sort of work that was done without permit and was probably not up to code. Given the slope of the side yard and the retaining wall at the property line, Bronfen probably should have had a team of civil engineers out here before he opened that first sack of ready-mix. I removed the dangling padlock from the hasp and let myself in. The interior was probably 8x10, smelling of loam, peat moss, and potting soil, overlaid with B1 and fish emulsion. There were no windows, and the light level had dropped by more than half. I felt around in the gloom, trying to find a light switch, but apparently the shed wasn't wired for electricity. I groped through my handbag till I came up with a penlight and shone it around. The beam illuminated a large expanse of wall-mounted pegboard, hung with gardening tools. A mower leaned against the wall, its blades flecked with grass clippings. There was a 6-foot workbench, its surface littered with clay pots, trowels, spilled potting soil, and discarded seed packs. Damp air clambered over my ankles and feet. Under the bench, I could see a gap in the rotting wood where a board had been pushed out. To the right was an oblong wooden bin with a hinged lid, knee-high, the sort of unit where tools are stored. A square of newly cut plywood had been nailed across one end. Big plastic bags of bark mulch and Bandini 101 were stacked on top. One of the bags had a rip in the bottom, and a trail of bark extended across the cracked cement floor. A pie-shaped wedge of track suggested that the bin had been dragged forward and then pushed back again. I thought about Agnes's torn knuckles and broken nails. I lifted my head. "Hello," I said, just to check the sound level. The word was muffled, as if absorbed by the shadows. I tried again. "Hello?" No echo at all. I doubted the noise carried 5 feet beyond the shed. If I'd abducted a half-senile old lady, this would be a neat place to stash her till I decided what to do. I balanced the penlight on the workbench and removed the 25-pound bags from the top of the bin, stacking them to one side. When I cleared the lid, I opened it and peered in. Empty. I retrieved the penlight and checked the rough interior surface. The space was easily the size of a coffin, and constructed so poorly that the airflow could probably sustain life, at least for a brief period. I ran the penlight from corner to corner, but there was no evidence of occupancy. I lowered the lid and restored the bags of mulch to their original positions. On my hands and knees, I checked the area around the bin. Nothing. I'd never be able to prove Agnes Gray had been here. As I backed out of the space, I caught a whiff of foul air, musty and sweet, like a faint wisp of smoke. I felt my skin contract with recognition, hairs standing at attention along the back of my neck. I could feel my lips purse with distaste. This was the odor of dead squirrel trapped in a chimney, rotting gopher parts left on the porch by your cat. Some creature guaranteed to perfume your nights until nature had completed the process of decomposition. Jesus! Where was it coming from? I raised myself up on my knees and fumbled across the workbench until I found the trowel. I ducked under the bench again, running my fingers lightly along the shed's concrete footing. The material was porous, softening with age, the texture mealy. I found a patch of crumbling mortar and began to dig with the trowel, gouging out a pocket. I turned the penlight off and worked by feel, using both hands. Under the hardened outer shell, the stuff felt gritty and wet, as if the groundwater had somehow seeped in, undermining the concrete. The smell seemed stronger. There was something dead down here. I tried the light again, working my way to the right, where I could see two horizontal cracks. I began to chop away at the concrete, doing more damage to the trowel than I was doing to the footing. I pulled myself to my feet again, searching the workbench for a more effective tool. Up on the pegboard, I spotted a short-handled hoe with a pick on the back side of the blade. I crawled back to my little strip mine and began to hack in earnest. I was making so much damn noise, it was a wonder the neighbors didn't complain. A hunk of cement fell away. Tentatively, I scooped some of the debris off, using the pick to excavate. I felt resistance, some sort of root, perhaps, or a length of rebar. I turned on the penlight again and peered into the space. "Oh, shit," I whispered. I was looking at the dorsal surface of a little finger bone. I scooted backward across the floor, bumping into the mower. I sucked air through my teeth as my banged elbow sang. The pain was a welcome diversion under the circumstances. I flicked the light off and scrambled to my feet. I shoved a bag of bark mulch in front of the hole and snagged my handbag. I was making little whimpering sounds as I whipped out of the door again. I placed the padlock where it had been and danced away from the shed with a spasm of revulsion. For a moment, all I could do was shiver, slapping at my arms as if to aid circulation. I paced in a circle, trying to think what to do. I breathed deeply. God, that was vile. From the glimpse I'd had, the bone had been there for years. Whatever the odor, it wasn't emanating from that. But what else was down there? In the fading afternoon light, the zigzagging foundation seemed to glow. Someone had been adding outbuildings from time to time. First the lath house had been attached to the garage, then the potting shed had been attached to that. Extending from the side of the potting shed, there was a pad where firewood was stacked. If Anne Bronfen, in the guise of Agnes Gray, was accounted for, then the body had to be Sheila's. Bronfen claimed his wife had run away with Irene, but I didn't believe a word of it. I did one of those all-over body shutters, thinking about the finger. All of the flesh was gone. I gave my head a shake and took two deep breaths, disconnecting my sensibilities. There had to be other answers somewhere on the premises. I went back to the front door and knocked. I waited, hoping fervently that Bronfen wasn't back. Eventually, the old fellow shuffled his way to the door and opened it a crack. I had to clear my throat, assuming what I hoped was a normal tone of voice. "Me again," I chirped. "Could I come in and wait for Mr. Bronfen?" The old gent put a gnarly finger to his lips, giving my request some thought. Finally, he nodded and backed away from the door awkwardly, as if controlled by wires. I followed him into the house, quickly checking my watch. I'd been in the shed 20 minutes. I still had plenty of time if I could figure out what I was looking for. The old man crept toward the living room.
"You can have a seat in here. I'm Ernie."
"Nice to meet you, Ernie. Where did Mr. Bronfen go? Did he say anything to you?"
"No, I don't believe so. He'll be home directly, I should think. Not long."
"Nice house," I said, peering into the living room. There I was, telling lies again. The house was shabby and smelled of cooked cabbage and peed-in pants. The furniture looked like it had been there since the turn of the century. The once-upon-a-time white curtains hung in limp wisps. The wallpaper in the hallway, with its motif of violets, fanned out in all directions like a bug infestation. Lucky for Clotilda, she hadn't qualified for occupancy. To the left, uncarpeted stairs led up to a second floor. I could see a dining room with a series of decorative plates on the wall. I moved toward the rear of the house, passing a small door that probably opened onto a little storage area under the stairs. Across from that was the basement door. "Is this the kitchen through here? I need to wash my hands." But I was talking to myself. Ernie had shuffled into the living room, forgetting me entirely. The kitchen was the prototype before in any home remodeling magazine. Cracked tile counters, black and white floor tiles, brown woodwork, stained sink, a dripping faucet. Someone, in a jaunty attempt to update the place, had covered the original wallpaper with a modern-day vinyl equivalent. Pale green fruits and vegetables intermixed with white and yellow daisies. Along the baseboard, the vinyl strip was curling up like a party favor. I checked the walk-in pantry. The shelves were lined with industrial-sized cans of hominy and peas. I went in and stood there, looking out at the kitchen with the door half shut. Irene Bronfen had been 4 when she left. I hunkered down, smelling soot, my eyes level with the doorknob. I returned to the hallway. The door to the storage space beneath the stairs was kept locked. I wondered if she'd used it as a playhouse. I hunkered there, looking left toward the kitchen. Not much visible from that vantage point. Murders are so often domestic affairs. Alcohol is a factor in more than 60%. 30% of the weapons in these murders are knives, which, after all, antedate gunpowder and don't have to be registered. As a matter of convenience, the kitchen is a favored location for crimes of passion these days. You can sit there with your loved ones, grabbing beers out of the fridge, adding ice to your scotch. Once your spouse makes a smart remark, the stakes can escalate until you reach for the knife rack and win the argument. I moved through the kitchen. At the rear of the house, there was an enclosed wooden porch, uninsulated board and batten, where an antique washer stood. The water heater was out there, looking too small and decrepit to provide much hot water to the residents. Irene at 4 had been somewhere in this house. I was willing to bet she'd been playing with the tea set. What had she told me? That the paint ran down the walls and ruined all the violets? I thought about her phobias: dust, spiders, closed spaces. I stood in the doorway, looking through the kitchen toward the hall. The ceilings were high, papered over all with the same repeating pattern of violets as the hall. The kitchen walls had been repapered, but not the ceiling itself. There must have been a time when it was the same throughout. I checked the baseboard near the stretch where the old icebox had once stood. In the wall above it was the square space with the little door to the exterior where the iceman had left his delivery. The next section of wall was a straight shot, floor to ceiling. I could feel my attention stray to the portion of the vinyl paper that was loose along the bottom. I leaned over and peeled a corner back. Under it was a paper sprigged with roses. Under that layer came the paper with the violets again. I got a grip on the lower edge of the vinyl panel, and I pulled straight up. The strip made a sucking sound as it raced up the wall, taking some of the sprigged paper with it. The rust-colored streaks were showing through, drab rivulets coursing through a field of violets, spatters of dull brown that had soaked into the paper, soaked into the plaster underneath. The blood had sprayed in an arc, leaping high along the wall, penetrating everything. Attempts to clean it had failed, and the second coat of paper had been layered over the first. Then a third coat over that. I wondered if current technology was sufficiently sophisticated to forge the link between the blood here and the body that was buried in the footing. Lottie was the first to go. Her death must have been passed off as natural, since she was buried with the rest. Emily must have come next, her skull crushed by falling bricks. And Sheila after that, with a story to cover her disappearance. That must have been the killing Agnes and Irene witnessed. Bronfen had probably made up the story of Sheila's departure. I doubted there were any neighbors left who could verify the sequence of events. No telling what Bronfen had told them at the time. Some glib cover story to account for the missing. Agnes had been in exile for years, protecting Irene. I wondered what had tempted her to return to the house. Perhaps, after over 40 years, she thought the danger had passed. Whatever her motives, she was dead now, too. And Patrick, dear brother Patrick, was the only one left. I heard the front door shut. Chapter 27. The last chapter. He stood in the kitchen doorway, a brown grocery bag in his arms. He wore a dark green sports shirt and wash pants, belted below his waist. He was wheezing from exertion, sweat beating his face. His gaze was fixed on the length of vinyl wallpaper that now lay on the floor, folded over on itself. His gaze traveled up the wall and then jerked across to mine.
"What did you do that for?"
"Time to take care of old business, my friend." He crossed to the kitchen table and set the grocery bag down. He removed some items, toilet paper, a dozen eggs, a pound of butter, a loaf of bread, and set them on the table. I could see him try to settle on an attitude, the proper tone. He'd been rehearsing this in his mind for years, probably confident the conversation was one he could handle with a perfect air of innocence. The problem was, he'd forgotten what innocence felt like or how it was supposed to look.
"What old business?"
"All the blood on the wall, for one." The pause was of the wrong length.
"What blood?"
"That's a redwood stain. I refinished a piece of porch furniture and knocked the can off on the floor. Stuff sprayed all over, went every place. You never saw such a mess."
"Arterial blood will do that. You get a pumping effect."
I tromped over the crumpled strip of paper with a scrabbling sound and washed my hands at the kitchen sink. He put a half gallon of ice cream in the freezer, taking a moment to rearrange boxes of frozen vegetables. His rhythm was off. An accomplished liar knows how important the timing is in conveying nonchalance. I dried my hands on a kitchen towel of doubtful origin. It might have been a part of a pillowcase, a paint rag, or a diaper.
"I drove over to Mount Calvary and looked for Anne's grave."
"Make your point. I got work to do.
She's buried with the family on the side of the hill."
"Not quite," I said. I leaned against the counter, watching him unload canned goods. I went into the office and asked to see the interment card. "You bought her a stone, but there's no body in the grave. Anne left town with Irene in January 1940. He tried to get huffy, but he couldn't muster any heat.
"I paid to bring her all the way from Tucson, Arizona. If she wasn't in the coffin, don't tell me about it. Ask the fellow on the other end who said he put her there."
"Oh, come on," I said. "Let's cut to the chase. There wasn't any husband in Arizona, and there weren't any little kids. You made that stuff up. You killed Charlotte and Emily. You killed Sheila, too. Anne was alive until late last night, and she told me most of it. She said Emily wanted to sell the house, and you refused. She must have pressed the point, and you were forced to eliminate her just to end the argument.
Once you got Emily out of the way, there was only Anne to worry about. Have her declared dead, and you collect the whole estate.
He began to shake his head.
You're a crazy woman. I got nothing to say to you.
I crossed to the wall-mounted telephone near the hall door.
Fine with me, I don't care. You can talk to Lieutenant Dolan as soon as he gets here.
Now he was willing to argue the point, any means to delay.
I wouldn't kill anyone. Why would I do that?
Who knows what your motivation was? Money is my guess.
I don't know why you did it, I just know you did. I did not.
Sure you did. Who are you trying to kid?
You don't have a shred of proof. You can't prove anything.
I can't, but somebody can. The cops are really smart, Patrick. And persistent? My God, you have no idea how persistent they are where murder's concerned. The whole of modern technology will be brought to bear. Lab techs, machinery, sophisticated tests. They've got experts out the wazoo, and what do you have? Nothing. A lot of hot air. You don't stand a chance. 50 years ago you might have fooled them, but not these days. You're up shit creek, pal. You are totally screwed.
Now see here, you wait a minute, young lady. I won't have that kind of talk used in my house, he said.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. You've got standards. You're not going to tolerate a lot of smutty talk from me, right? I turned back to the telephone. I had picked up the receiver when the window shattered in the back. The two acts came so close together, it looked like cause and effect. I pick up the phone, the window breaks. Startled, I jumped a foot and dropped the phone in the process, jumping again as the handset thumped against the wall. I saw a hand come through the shattered window and reach around to unlock the door. One savage kick and the door swung back abruptly and banged against the wall. I had grabbed my handbag and was just reaching for my gun when Mark Messenger appeared, his own gun drawn and pointed at me. The suppressor created the illusion of a barrel 14 inches long. This time there was no smile, no aura of sexuality. His blonde hair stood out around his head in damp spikes. His blue eyes were as cold and as blank as stone. Patrick had turned, heading toward the front door in haste. Messenger fired at him casually, not even pausing long enough to form an intent. The shooting as simple as pointing a finger.
Split!
The sound of the silenced 45 semi-automatic was almost dainty compared to its effect. The force of the bullet drove Patrick into the wall, where he bounced once before he fell. Blood and torn flesh bloomed in his chest like a chrysanthemum, shreds of cotton shirting like the calyx of a flower. I was staring at him, mesmerized, when Messenger grabbed me by the hair, hauling my face up within an inch of his. He shoved the barrel of his gun under my chin, pressing so hard it hurt. I wanted to protest the pain of it, but I didn't dare move.
"Don't shoot me."
"Where's Eric?" he breathed.
"I don't know."
"You're going to help me get him back."
Fear had pierced my chest wall like splinters. All the adrenaline was coursing upward to my brain, driving out thought. I had a brief image of Dietz with Rochelle Messenger. They'd evidently succeeded in plucking the kid from his father's grasp. I could smell chlorine from the swimming pool, mingled with Messenger's breath. He probably couldn't take his gun to the pool without calling attention to himself. I pictured him in the water, Eric on the side, just waiting to jump in. If his mother appeared, he'd have run straight to her with a shriek of joy. By now they were probably barreling out to the airport. The plane had been chartered for 9 to allow time for the snatch. I willed the thought away, made my mind blank. Messenger slapped me across the face hard, setting up a ringing in my head. I was dead. I wouldn't get out of this one alive. He shoved me toward the back door, kicking a chair out of my path. I caught sight of Ernie, the old guy, shuffling toward the kitchen. His expression was perplexed, especially when he spotted Patrick on the floor with a corsage of blood pinned to the center of his chest. Mark Messenger turned and pointed the gun at the old man.
"Oh, don't!" I burbled.
My voice sounded strange, high-pitched and hoarse. I squeezed my eyes shut and waited for the split. I looked back. The old fellow had pivoted and was shuffling away in panic. I could hear his howls echo down the hall, as frail and helpless as a child's. Messenger watched him retreat, indecision flickering in his eyes. He lost interest and turned his attention back to me.
"Get the car keys."
I saw the bag where I'd dropped it on the floor near the phone. I pointed, temporarily unable to speak. I longed for my gun.
We'll take my car. You drive.
He grabbed me by the head and buried his grip in my hair again, propelling me with a fury that made me cry out in fear.
Shut up, he whispered.
His face was close to mine as we descended the back stairs. I stumbled, grabbing at the rail with my right hand for balance. My heel slipped off the stair and I nearly went down. I thought he'd pull all my hair out, effectively scalping me with his closed fist, which held me like a vice. I couldn't look down, couldn't move my head to either side. I could feel the gravel driveway underfoot. I proceeded like a blind woman, hands out, using senses other than sight. The car was parked in the drive near the shed. I wondered briefly if a neighbor would spot our clumsy progress. Nearly dark now. In my mind's eye, I could see Rochelle's face. Please be on the plane, I thought. Please be in the air. Take Dietz with you forever and keep him somewhere safe. I pictured his impatience, his intensity. I wheeled him into a taxi, drove him away from the danger. I couldn't save him, couldn't even save myself this time around. Messenger yanked open the door on the passenger side and pushed me across the front seat. He was driving a yellow Rolls-Royce, walnut dashboard, leather upholstery.
Start the car, he said.
He got in after me, crowding close. He placed the barrel of the gun against my temple. He was breathing hard, his tension concentrated in his grip on the gun. If he shot me, I wouldn't feel it. I'd be dead before the pain could travel along my nerve ends and get the message to my brain. I willed the act, wanted it over with.
Do it, he said.
I thought the voice was mine, so nearly did it mimic my thought.
Start the fucking car.
His anger was erratic, sometimes fire, sometimes ice, his command of himself veering inexplicably from unbridled impulse to rigid control. I felt for the keys in the ignition.
Where'd they take my son?
They didn't tell me.
You lying bitch! I'll tell you then.
He dropped his voice, and I could feel the force of his words against my cheek. The sexuality was back, the same tickle of desire that rises when you dance with a man for the first time, some awareness of the flesh and all the possibilities that wait. He was calm again, confident, his throaty laugh nearly jubilant.
Rochelle's got a twin brother flies a plane, he said. She knows better than to take Eric back to her place because I'd find him first thing and she'd be dead before she shut the door. She'll try to get him out by air, take him off and hide him somewhere till things cool down.
He moved the gun away from my head, gesturing with the barrel.
Back out on the street and take a left. We'll head out to the airport. There's a charter place out there. Drive carefully, okay?
I nodded dumbly, my mood shifting as abruptly as his. So far, I was alive, not maimed or disabled. I was grateful he hadn't hurt me, thrilled I wasn't dead. I did as I was told. I felt absurdly happy that his manner was pleasant, his tone nearly friendly as I backed out of the drive. He'd reduced my habitual cockiness to humility. There was still hope. There was still a chance. Maybe they'd already left. Maybe they were gone. Maybe I could kill him before he killed me. I had a flash of Rochelle being shot in the chest. He'd kill her as carelessly as he'd killed Patrick Bronfen, with the same matter-of-factness, the same casualness, the same ease. Dietz would die. Messenger would trade me for Eric at the outset and then kill us all. Rochelle, Dietz, and me, in whatever order would maximize the horror. I focused on the road, suddenly conscious of the car. I could smell leather seats, the fresh rose in a crystal vase. The car glided in silence. I turned right on 101 and flew north. There was not a highway patrol car in sight. My mouth was dry. I cleared my throat.
How did you know where I was?
I put a bug on the Porsche the first night it was parked in front of your place. See this? My receiver. I've been following you guys everywhere in a couple of different rental cars.
Why'd you kill Patrick?
Why not? He's a dick face.
I glanced over at him curiously. Why'd you spare Ernie?
That old fart? Who knows? Maybe I'll go back and do him now you mention it, he said.
His tone was teasing. A little hitman humor to show what a devil-may-care kind of guy he was. He'd taken the gun away from my head, and it rested now on his knee.
What's the story with this bodyguard? He's a pain in the ass.
Two times I nearly had you, and he stepped in.
I kept my eyes on the road.
He's good at his job.
He looked over at me.
You making it with him?
That's none of your business.
Come on.
I've only known him 4 days, I said righteously.
So what?
So I don't jump into bed with guys that quick.
You should have done while you had the chance. Now he's a dead man.
I'll make you a deal. How's this? Him or you?
Better yet, Rochelle or him. Take your pick. If you don't choose, I kill all three of you.
You're only getting paid for one.
True, but I'll tell you, the money doesn't mean that much. When you do what you love, you do it for free, am I right?
He leaned toward the tape deck.
Want some music? I got jazz, classical, R&B. No heavy metal or reggae. I hate that shit. You want Sinatra?
No, thanks. I saw the off-ramp for the university and the airport and eased right. The road curved up and to the left, crossing the freeway, which now passed underneath. It was gone, and we hit the straightaway. 2 more minutes to the airport, and what was I going to do? The digital clock on the instrument panel showed that it was 8:02. A mile farther on, the access ramp to Rock Pit Road came into view on the right. I took the turn. I knew the ocean was close by, but all I could smell was the rotten egg odor of the slough that hugged the road. A fog was rolling in, a dense bank of white against the blackened sky. The university sat up on the bluffs like a walled city, all lights and buff-colored towers. I'd never gone to college. I was strictly blue-collar lineage. Like this guy, come to think of it. Like Dietz. I took Rock Pit for half a mile until the hangars and assorted outbuildings of Neptune Air appeared on the left.
Here, he said.
I slowed the rolls and turned in. Messenger sat forward, peering through the windshield, which had been spritzed with fine mist. There were 4 miscellaneous vehicles parked in the lot, but there was no sign of Rochelle's rental car. Messenger had me park the rolls in the lee of a metal-sided hangar. Under the inverted V of the roof line, illuminated by a single bulb, the sign read, Flight Instruction, FAA Repair Station, 24-Hour Charters, Piper Dealer, and Avionics Sale and Services. The perimeter fence was made of chain link, wrapped with barbed wire on top and padlocked. Warnings were posted at intervals. Floodlights on the far side of the hangar glowed blankly on the empty runway. We left the car. It was cold, and a wind whipped along the tarmac, blowing my hair in all directions. As we crossed the parking lot, Messenger took me by the elbow in a gesture so reminiscent of Dietz that the air caught in my throat. The offices of Neptune Air were closed, the interior darkened, one dim light shining through the plate glass. We circled the building. A broad redwood deck stretched out across the rear. A picnic table and 2 benches had been set up for those waiting for their charter flights. I pictured the Neptune employees, all 3 of them, eating lunch out here, watching planes land, drinking canned sodas from the vending machine. To the right, there was a line of small private planes tied down on the tarmac. Beyond them, half a mile away, I could see the Santa Teresa Airport, the upper portion of its tower peeking up above a row of storage sheds. On one of the runways, a United 737 was lumbering across the field in preparation for takeoff. Messenger gestured, and we sat down on opposite sides of the picnic table.
"It's fucking cold out," he said.
I heard voices behind me. I turned and watched as 2 workmen, probably fuelers, locked the exit door to the hangar and moved off toward the parking lot. Messenger rose to his feet, peering in their direction. He pulled the nose of the 45 up and pointed, making little noises with his mouth. Pow, pow. He blew imaginary smoke away from the barrel, and then he smiled.
They don't know how lucky they are, do they?
I guess not, I said. He sat down again. His hair had dried into ringlets, and the wind lifted them playfully. His eyes glinted in the light from a bulb at the upper corner of the building. He was watching me with interest.
Your daddy ever bring you out here to watch planes?
He died when I was 5.
Mine didn't either. Cocksucker. No wonder I turned out bad.
What, he didn't show up to watch you play Little League?
He didn't do much of anything except drink, fornicate, and kill folk. That's where I got all my talent, from him.
My fear had receded, and in its place I was beginning to feel a characteristic crankiness settle in. It was one thing to die, and quite another being forced to sit around in a cold wind making small talk with a fatuous ass like Messenger. I'd been thinking I better make nice. Now I wondered what the point was. In the meantime, he was staring at my face. I stared back, just to see what it would feel like. He nodded judiciously.
Your black eye's looking better.
I ran a finger along my orbital ridge. I kept forgetting what I must look like to the uninitiated observer. The last time I'd assayed my various injuries, I'd noticed the bruises had changed hues dramatically. A lemon-yellow backdrop now blended into lime green, which was overlaid with plum.
You nearly got me that round.
He waved the compliment away.
That was just a warm-up. I wasn't serious.
What did Eric think of it?
Didn't bother him. Look at cartoons. Kids see violence all the time, and it doesn't count for shit. People don't really die. It's all special effects.
I doubt he's going to feel that way if you shoot his mom.
Not if I shoot her. When?
I saw his gaze shift. Out on the runway, a tiny plane had landed, sounding like a VW in need of a new fan belt. I lost sight of the aircraft behind some outbuildings, and then the plane appeared again, puttering toward us. He got to his feet.
I bet this is him. Come on, and keep your mouth shut or I'll pop you one.
The plane reached the concrete apron beside the hangar, and the pilot made a miniature U-turn so that he was now facing out toward the runway. He cut the engine, doused the lights. Messenger had gripped me across the back of the neck, marching me toward the plane in quick step. I imagined the pilot taking off his headset, writing in his logbook, loosening his seat belt. If this was Rochelle's brother, he was going to recognize Messenger as soon as he caught sight of him. A column of fear wafted up my spine like smoke. I tried to hang back, resisting, but Messenger's fingers dug into my neck with excruciating pain. We had picked up the pace, almost trotting side by side, until we reached the tail unit of the plane. Just in front of us, the door to the cockpit opened and the pilot stepped down. We were less than 6 feet away. Messenger said,
"Hey, Roy!"
I screamed a warning. The pilot turned in surprise. "Spwit!" Roy dropped to his knees. He toppled forward on his face. His nose had been shattered by the bullet, which took out a chunk of skull when it exited. I cried out in horror, recoiling from the sight. I felt tears like a stinging blow. A quick cloud of gunpowder perfumed the night air. I put a hand against the plane for support. Messenger had already lifted the dead man by the arms, and he was dragging him backward across the tarmac toward the slanted shadows of the hangar. I pushed away from the plane. I took off, running for dear life. I headed toward the parking lot, hoping to reach the road.
"Hey!"
I could hear Messenger behind me, pounding hard. I didn't dare look. He was faster than I, and he was gaining. I felt the shove that sent me tumbling forward on my hands. I tried to roll, but I wasn't quick enough to save myself. I was down, and he was on me, winded and raging. He pulled me over on my back. I kept my arms up to ward off the blows he aimed at me. Something caught his attention, and his face jerked up. A car was approaching from the direction of the slough. He pulled me to my feet, half-dragging, half-hauling me across the concrete toward the shelter of the building. He backed up against the stucco, my body clamped against his, half-tucked under his armpit. He had his one hand across my mouth, the barrel of the gun at my temple again. I was close to suffocation, both of us breathing hard. The car pulled into the parking lot. I heard two car doors slam, one right after the other, and then the murmur of voices. I saw Rochelle first, heard her heels tapping on the pavement, saw the pale cheeks, the pale hair above the turned-up collar of her trench coat. Eric walked beside her, his face tilted toward hers. The two were holding hands. Dietz was locked up close to her, his attention focused on the surrounding darkness. When he spotted the plane, he hesitated. I could almost see his puzzled squint. He put an arm out to stop Rochelle's progress, and Eric halted in his tracks. Messenger pushed us away from the building.
"Hey, pal, over here. Look what I got."
For a moment, the five of us formed a tableau. I felt like we were part of a pageant, some community theater group acting out a well-known scene from history. No one moved. Messenger had removed his hand from my mouth, but none of us said a word.
Finally, Eric seemed to perk up.
Daddy?
Hey, big fella, how are you doing? I came to pick you up. Rochelle said,
Mark, let me have him back. I beg you. You've had him 8 months. Let him stay with me, please.
Despite the distance between us, the voices carried easily.
No way, babe, that's my kid. Tell you what, though, I'll make a deal. I get Eric, you get Kinsey, fair enough?
Dietz glanced at Rochelle.
He won't hurt Eric.
Rochelle lashed out at Dietz.
Shut up, this is between us.
He'll kill her,
Dietz said.
I don't give a shit, she snapped.
Messenger cut in.
Excuse me, Dietz, I hate to interrupt, but you're never going to win an argument with her. She's a hard-headed bitch. Believe me, I know.
Dietz was silent, looking at him. Rochelle had put her arms around Eric possessively, holding him against her, much as Messenger held me. Messenger was concentrating on Dietz for the moment.
I'd appreciate your taking your gun out, pal. Could you do that? I don't want to have to blow this lady's brains out quite yet. I thought you might like to say goodbye to each other first.
How serious are you about a deal?
Dietz said.
Let's do the gun first, okay? Then we'll negotiate. I have to tell you, I'm feeling tense. I got a .45 with the safety off, and the trigger only takes 2 pounds of pressure. You might want to move kind of slow.
Dietz seemed to proceed in slow motion, removing his gun from the middle of the back holster he was wearing under his tweed sport coat. He held the barrel upright and removed the magazine, which he tossed out on the pavement. I could hear the metal clatter on concrete as he kicked it away. He tossed the gun over his shoulder into the dark. He held his hands up, palm out. Dietz and I exchanged a look. I could feel Messenger's tension through the bones of my back. I was warmer, laid up against him, and if I didn't move my head, I was hardly aware of the gun barrel. The length of it with the suppressor attached prevented him from pointing it, end-on, at my head. He was forced to hold it at an angle. I wondered if the sheer weight of it wasn't becoming burdensome. Messenger was apparently watching Dietz with care.
Very nice. Now why don't you persuade Rochelle to cooperate? See if you can talk her into it, because if not, I'm about to collect on this $1,500 hit.
Rochelle said,
Why don't you ask Eric what he wants to do?
Messenger's tone was condescending.
Because he's too young to make a decision about his own custody. Jesus Christ, Rochelle, I don't believe some of the shit you come up with. That's just the kind of attitude makes you a terrible parent, you know that? If he stayed with you, you'd turn him into some kind of little fruit. Now let's cut the horseshit and make a little trade here. Just send Eric over and we'll see what we can do.
Dietz looked at Rochelle.
Do what he says.
She said nothing. She stared at Messenger, and then her gaze shifted over to me.
I don't believe you. You'll kill her anyway.
No, I won't, he said as if falsely accused. That's why I brought her out here, to trade. I'd never welsh on a deal where my kid is concerned. Are you nuts?
Dietz said to her,
You'll have another chance to get Eric back. I promise. We'll help you. Just do this for now.
Even at that distance, I could see her face crumple. She gave Eric a little push.
Go on.
She was starting to cry, hands shoved down in her coat pockets. Eric hesitated, looking from her face to his father's.
It's all right, Angel, she said.
He began to walk toward us rapidly, head down, his face hidden. Messenger's grip on me tightened, and I could smell the tawny sweat of sex oozing out of his pores. Time seemed to slow as the kid crossed the pavement. All I could hear was the sound of the wind chuffing across the runway. Eric reached us. I'd never really seen him up close. His face was like a valentine, all pink cheeks, blue eyes, long lashes. So vulnerable. His ears stuck out slightly, and his neck seemed too thin.
Don't hurt her, Daddy.
I wouldn't do that, Messenger said. The car's parked on the far side of the hangar. You can wait for me over there. Here's the keys.
Mark?
Rochelle's voice sounded faint against the distant droning of an incoming plane. Tears were streaming down her face.
Can I kiss him goodbye?
I heard him mutter, Christ. He raised his voice.
Come ahead, then, but make it quick.
To Eric, he said,
You wait here for your mommy, and then you go get in the car, like I said. You eat any supper?
We stopped at McDonald's and had a Big Mac.
I don't believe it. You remember what I told you about junk food?
Eric nodded, his eyes filling with tears. It was hard to know which parent he was supposed to listen to. In the meantime, Rochelle was walking toward us along a straight line, setting her high heels down one in front of the other, as if in modeling school. Over her shoulder, Dietz's gaze locked down on mine. I thought he smiled his encouragement. I didn't want to see Dietz die, didn't think I could bear it, didn't want to live myself if it came down to that. I looked at Rochelle. She'd stopped a few feet away. Eric walked over and buried his face against her. She leaned forward and laid her cheek against the top of his head. She was weeping openly.
"I love you," she whispered. "You be a good boy, okay?"
He nodded mutely and then pulled away, hurrying toward the rolls without a backward look. His father called after him.
"Hey, Eric, there's some tapes in the glove compartment. Play anything you like."
Rochelle stared at Mark. She pulled the Derringer out of her pocket, aimed it straight at his head, and pulled the trigger. The blast was remarkably loud for a weapon so petite. I heard his scream. He dropped the .45 and clutched his right eye with both hands, toppling sideways onto the pavement where he lay writhing in pain. Rochelle, with an efficiency she must have learned from him, stepped in close and fired again.
"You son of a bitch! You never honored a deal in your fucking life!"
Messenger lay still. Dietz began to cross the tarmac, moving toward me. I went out to meet him. Epilogue. When the cops finally tore up the area around Bronfen's potting shed, four bodies came to light. The one buried in the footing was tagged as a former resident of the Borden Care, whose pension checks Bronfen had been cashing for a good 5 months. The pathologists are still working to identify the remaining dead, but one is most assuredly Bronfen's wife, Sheila. Irene is doing better now that she knows the truth. She's found a good therapist who's helping her sort it all out. It may take her years yet, but at least she's on the right path. A third and final hired assassin was apprehended in Carson City shortly after Messenger was killed. Yesterday I spoke to Lee Galashoff, who told me Tyrone Patty died of a knife wound, the result of a dispute with an inmate half his size. As for Dietz, he was with me until August 29th, when the job he was hoping for materialized. He's in Germany now, filming mock infiltrations of military bases. He swears he's coming back. I'd like to believe him, but I'm not sure I dare. In the meantime, I have work of my own to do, and a life that feels richer for his having been a part of it. Respectfully submitted. Kinsey Milhone. This concludes the reading of G is for Gumshoe by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer.